sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The shutdown continues. Earnings season, stocks to watch. China's exports just flop. And we do have John Perkins today, Confessions of an Economic Hitman author. All this and much more on this edition, number 334 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello, how are you? How are you dealing with the shutdown? Is it causing you any problems? I heard a really interesting discussion from some of the fishermen out there that are having all sorts of trouble because some of the inspectors are not able to work, and it's funneling down into the seafood industry, and that could cause a problem with things like the cost of, you know, fish, shellfish. I hope it doesn't hit shrimp and crab. That would be a bummer. But it is causing all sorts of little ripple effects far and wide, and it doesn't seem that if we get some kind of a compromise, it's not going to be worthwhile at all because there's not enough time. We're at a point right now that we're dealing with a race to the debt ceiling, the amount of money that can be borrowed by the government in order to pay its debts. And the problem is that here we are, but when we're talking about this and when this is released on the 13th of October, we're talking about 3 days or so away from the limit and the D-Day on the debt ceiling. Now, the problem is that we're getting so close that this whole idea of pressing and using as a quote-unquote bargaining chip the debt ceiling has become so onerous and so overwhelming that no bills can really get by here. In other words, what the intent should have been on all of this was to fix whatever needed fixing. If it was maybe some of the tax code, maybe some of the spending, maybe some of the negative parts of the Obamacare, whatever it was, that was what should have been being dealt with months ago, not leaving it to a point where we're going to get ourselves into a pickle. And the only thing that's going to happen is a street fight, which can come out to nothing more than a draw, each side saying they won and not getting anything really accomplished other than the fact that either a delay, which would be very bad, and I think Obama, President Obama, did a really good job at saying, hey, you know what, he's not going to take just a small extension here. He talked about the fact prior that he wouldn't, and now he stood by his ground. And I think that was really good because, not because we want a shutdown, not because I want him to be stubborn, and not because I want his side or the other side, but because, you know, at the same time, there is a limit to the amount that you can do things for political gain. And it's clear that many of the Tea Party players are involved in this for political gain. Now, at the same time, many of the Republicans who signed on to this idea of changing things from where they were and doing it in a way that would be confrontational with regard to the spending bill and the debt ceiling, okay, they went into this because they wanted to get something done. But this has turned out to be an absolute fiasco. You can't let the U.S. default, even for a second, on its debt. Majorly bad things happen. It's not good. It's not good that we have this going forward and this bluff, this gigantic poker bluff going on right now to see who flinches first, because markets aren't going to be too happy about it. There's going to be all sorts of problems. Already we saw J.P. Morgan and a few other players selling off their short-term debt. Now, on the other side, we saw that Bill Gross said he's going to buy it all. Fidelity was selling it off too. All the really short-term debt due, you know, at the end, I guess it was the end of October through the second week to the end of October through the first couple of weeks in November, thinking that if there was a default, those are the ones that would be defaulted upon. the first ones that have to be repaid, and that would be a problem. So I don't want to get too involved in this because it's very distracting, I think, from the bigger picture, which has its own set of variables that we need to discuss. We need to talk about the global situation when it comes to China. We need to talk about the earnings that are going to be coming out. We had a few of them last week, and they're really going to hit the tape this week pretty strong. And some ideas of what's going on with markets and how we should be best invested. The problem is that, once again, the government is the overriding issue when it comes to markets. As a matter of fact, this goes both ways. Because there was an article out, or at least a news item out, over the weekend that says that Senator Schumer says he's worried about Monday's stock drop on the default risk. Let me just read this to you, and then I'll give you my thoughts on this. He says he's worried whether the stock market will go down and interest rates will go up if an impasse continues. Even so, he's considerably more optimistic today than he was yesterday, and because of some of the meetings. Now, here's the problem. Senator Schumer, with all due respect, the idea of whether or not the markets go up or down has nothing to do with what you're trying to accomplish here. And it shouldn't be used as talking points. And whether it's a Democrat or Republican, the idea that they are doing their best to make sure that America is fully employed and that we have a very good growth engine for economics into the future, as well as the most efficient government possible, is what you should be worried about. The stock market will take care of itself. But this goes to show you just how ridiculous it's become with these congressmen and women and the administration and everybody in between, how they're so worried about the stock market. I mean, why should he be worried? So if the stock market goes down 10%, think about how far we've come. If earnings are there, they'll go back anyway. If earnings aren't there, it doesn't matter what he thinks. But to think that they are doing all they can because they're so nervous about the stock market, I mean, it's really ridiculous. It's almost insulting. These are the kind of things that make me just scratch my head and wonder what these guys and gals are doing up there in Washington. It's so repulsive to think about the fact that they are actually worried about this, and whether or not it's a personal matter because they're invested in the markets, or whether it's because they think, well, if the markets go down, my constituents and my voting bloc are going to be really upset with me. Well, big problems. Mr. Schumer, please focus in on all the details of the bills that are passing your desk and make an independent and informed decision on whether or not that will be good or bad for the economy and for us as citizens of the country moving forward. And this goes for every single person that is seated in any political office, whether it's local or whether it's all the way up the chain through the administration, through the presidency. Please focus on the right things. Thank you. Write a letter to your congressman, why don't you? Tell him it's ridiculous, it's stupid, and it's just insulting that they would be, in fact, looking at the markets in such a manner to make decisions. Now, let's talk about some of the things that are coming up. We have Frank Curzio coming up. I believe it's next week. We have a Wall Street watchdog that will be coming up in 2 weeks, and we'll that should be fun. The Wall Street watchdog. We'll talk about some things. I guess we'll discuss, why that nobody went to jail at this point, and why, in fact, we have a situation where, both government and companies, private companies, can actually do the things they do, and who is the watchdog watching after. We also have Rodney Johnson coming on and a few other people in the next few weeks. We're booked for the next, 5 or 6 weeks at least. So that's good to know, and some exciting things that we'll talk about. Now, I wanted to also discuss, before we get to our guest, the news that we saw over the weekend on China. Now, we did see that China's manufacturing numbers came up a bit, and we saw the service index held, and okay, that was all good. Because they were really in a 8 or 9 month downtrend for some time when it came to all of those numbers. But one of the things we also learned over the summer was that China has possibly been putting out some bad numbers. Now, for a long time, if you remember, there was a lot of people that were crying wolf about this. there was a lot of people who said, hey, you know what? You can't trust these numbers. There's something wrong. There's a lot of corruption there. And anything that you see out of China, it just cannot be counted on. And those people were pretty much laughed off. You know what? Fine. The conspiracy theories, the idea that a government is trying to, you know, make some. Well, we later learn they're right. Now, maybe not on all of the numbers. We don't know this. But we clearly saw that on their imports and exports were padded by cross-border movement of currencies, gold, metals, etc., that were packed as one thing and sent as another and booked on the books on another and then double and triple counted over a period of time. China stood up and said, you know what? We found this out. We realize there's a problem here. And what they do? They just changed it and withdrew those out of the numbers, and now we have a new set of numbers. Now, if you recall, one of the things I was very concerned about when I heard that, and we talked about this, is that now what happens? Are we going to see the numbers that come out now when we do a year-over-year comparison compared to an adjusted number? Or are we going to see it compared to the real number or quote-unquote real number that they put out? In other words, the last reported number without any adjustments. Who knows? And because they didn't tell us, how do we know what to do? Well, analysts came out with some estimates on the numbers for exports, and they were expecting about a 5% number. Now, remember, they were much higher for some time. And they thought this number would be because the comparison of exports on a year-over-year basis utilizing the quote-unquote bad numbers where China didn't do anything to adjust. And by the way, China, why didn't you adjust them? Should have gone back in history. It doesn't take too long. Gone back in history and adjusted them all backwards to make the numbers not only representative of accuracy, but also so that we could see the trends and what's happening. Now we just got these big blips going on. They come out with numbers this weekend, though, and it wasn't up 5%. It was actually only up about, it was down 0.3%. Now, this is from an August number that was down, also compared to the last one. It was 7.2% in August. September, then it rose a little bit that one month that it did rise. And September 2002, going back a year now, they were up 9.2%. So what we're seeing is this comparison against a 9% number a year ago to the newest numbers that we're seeing, and we're seeing a drop of about 0.3%. That's very bad, especially when there was an expectation to be up 5.5%. Now, what does this tell us? Well, this tells us that the continuation of the global slowdown, in particular in the emerging markets, is not over. The stock market recovered there and had a gorgeous rally when the news came out that there was, in fact, a better month on a variety of the metrics in China. But we're going to have to see what happens here. Now, one of two things is going to happen. Either there's going to be a gigantic move down and then very quickly up again because the thought that there will be more stimulus and more actions by the government that will help along, whether it's by change in tariffs, whether it's by changing the speed and velocity of how they change their currency valuation against others, or whether it is an expansion of loans and lending, whatever it may be, we're going to find that the markets have still embedded in them the idea that there is a good amount of stimulus. The question is, that did also have an effect for some time when the markets were coming down, but it didn't hold as much, because China was doing everything they could to rein in the idea that there was a lot of speculation going on in the housing area, and also there was some inflation. Now, Brazil, for the fifth time, raised their interest rates last week. Brazil is having a substantial problem, and all of the distraction that's being created and concern being created by the government shutdown and inability to create some kind of a binding and even a comprehensive change to their current laws that they want in unison, and the bickering that's going on is creating a lot more uncertainty, and it's being, I think it's going to be transmitted very well to the emerging markets again. Again, they did come back nicely, many of the emerging markets. They had that nice stretch of move in the month of September after they really got clobbered for some time. But the question is going to be, how are their currencies going to react moving forward? Already, the yen has been continuing to come down, or I should say strengthen. It's inversely related. So it strengthens. It's, it was, well over 100 and change for some time. Crude oil is coming down. There was a mini crash of gold last week on Friday, for no apparent reason. It was about a $30 plunge on gold and an equally intense percentage change on silver at the start of the trading day, and then just kind of didn't go anywhere for the rest of the day. Why was that? Well, there's been some word that India is selling their gold. You know, they're having a lot of difficulty in India, and their currency is all out of whack. And we've talked about this a few weeks ago. I believe it was with Das, and we talked about the whole idea of India's rupee and what's happening there, and what, in fact, how their economy is reacting to all this. So the idea that the flow of all this information, and even with Janet Yellen going to be there to really do her job at passing out stimulus and not reducing it down till things are better, which is great. Question is, if it keeps on weakening the dollar, and if that is the intent or that is the side effect, what's going to happen with the emerging markets? That's a big concern of mine. So last week, we did see that the key reversal indicator that we show from time to time and give you some insight into that, it did hit back in about a month ago when Bernanke came out with that surprise. It hit we got a little cluster and a couple of strokes of four on it, and that was pretty high. It didn't breach the five level, which is kind of interesting. But we got to four, and then there was that cluster that we show with the little dots on top of it, and it rolled down from there, the markets. And this is a measure of the S&P 500 index. Very nice, back-tested level of oversold or overbought. We call it overheated. A market condition where you can look at that from a very broad stroke and say, okay, you know, if we're very overheated, that means that there's a good likelihood there could be a reversal coming. It may not be a permanent reversal, but, you know, stocks have too much froth in them right now in general. And if you're investing in stocks, you know, that for the most part, I don't know, 80% of stocks will follow a market on any given period of time in the short term. Now, we saw that come down, and the KRI came down, and it hit a -2. -2, not a big negative, but it did get some of the froth out of the markets. And then, at the end of the week last week, it leveled off to a zero. So we have what we call a market in equilibrium. Now, why am I telling you all this? Because usually what happens is that we see when there's a condition that develops, especially with the clusters that I mentioned, where you see a move to the top or to the bottom, and it's pretty sharp and it stays there and it moves into that level where the cluster is forming. What then has to happen is eventually a reversal of that to a point that you kind of subtract out the froth or the upside or the downside, so it comes back into a level that is, again, in equilibrium. You just don't get back to equilibrium. You have to go past it and down, and almost like an equal-sided move, because you'll have too far of a move on one way, and then it needs to come back. Some people would say this reversion to the mean. Okay, but we're not there yet. We need some more flush out to really get there. And we'll see if the markets can really are going to go that direction, or if we just get some kind of a deal at the last minute, whether it's going to be on Monday or Tuesday or... you won't have much more time than that, I guess, that if markets really do a good job at recovering and money is just pressed into there. Again, we are still getting the $85 billion per month, so, you know, that's a big issue. Now, let's get to our guest. When we get back, we're going to talk about the earnings that are coming up, some of the eco too, but the earnings, I'm going to focus in on about 10 companies that I'm going to talk to you about, because this week in particular is the first week of the big batch of numbers, a lot of financials. But we're going to talk about some of the other ones that really are key to watch to see how the economy and, in fact, how the earnings may progress through the rest of the quarter. So we'll talk about that right when we get back from John Perkins. We haven't talked to this special fella for some time, author of several amazing books, Confessions of an Economic Hitman and Hoodwinked, his latest Shape Shifting, and we'll talk about all of that. John, how are you?
I'm great, thank you. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. I want to kind of start backward start historically at the beginning and work our way up a little bit. Now, just for those of you that don't know John Perkins, yes, he's an author, and he has a tremendous amount of experience in the areas of, we'll call it, economics, and what else would we say that is? Global persuasion? Would that be the right?
I guess that's a good way to put it as any.
Your first book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which was, I think, 70 weeks on the bestseller list. You know, the whole idea behind that was all about, I mean, if I can sum it up for a moment, you know, the idea that the U.S. would go to a variety of countries and provide all sorts of loans and infrastructure development. And the end idea was just to grab the oil and other natural resources, right? Is that the summation?
Yeah, that's essentially, you know, we would identify countries that had any resources that we wanted, that we covet. Like oil would be often was a major one, but it might be bauxite or cheap labor, for that matter, and then arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sister organizations. But the money never actually went to the country. It went to our own organizations, our own corporations, to build infrastructure projects in that country, power plants, highways, things that would benefit a few wealthy families. But the majority of the people didn't gain anything because they can't drive on highways. They don't have cars.
Right.
They don't buy much electricity. Yet the country would be left holding a debt they couldn't repay. So at that point, we'd go back and we basically hit them over a barrel, you know, like sell us your oil or whatever the resource is real cheap. Sell off your public service sectors to us, your utility companies, your water and sewage, your schools, to, you know, your jails, whatever, to our corporations. Basically, we created an empire that way.
So essentially, we exhausted the ability to make anything more out of what we had here in the U.S., right? So we went outside, is the thesis, to get that.
Well, it wasn't. I mean, as it turns out, we've got quite a lot of oil in this country and so on, but it's historically what empires do. You know, you expand out of your borders. You try to take over as much as you can. And of course, when this really got underway toward the end of World War II, the Cold War is coming in, and we're seeing ourselves competing with the Soviet Union. So there was that other factor too, that we wanted global domination. We wanted our form, capitalism, to win out over the Soviet form. So that was a driving force for many years.
And what's interesting is that this whole, and then we had the Cold War, and we had, you know, it was always the two biggies, right? The U.S. versus Russia in some way or another. And we usually take the opposite side of any argument or any kind of government, a global issue. And all of a sudden, that's popping up again. Have you noticed that?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Isn't it interesting, too, how Russia's raising its head? And in fact, in a way, Putin saved Obama, you know, when he stepped in and figured out a possible deal with Syria that would sort of help Obama save face with Congress and with the people.
Do you think that was his original intentions?
You know, I've heard there's a backstory there that Obama and Putin had been discussing this, or their representatives had, sometime in advance, that maybe it was a set-up deal. I think Putin is out to regain Russian hegemony, to regain Russian power, and this is one way that he sees of doing it.
I mean, I think he's pretty cool. He'd ride, you know, galloping around on his horses with no shirt on. I mean, that's not the usual stance you would see from a president, right? A ruler?
That's true. Well, you know, he's ex-KGB. He's a martial arts expert, and he's a tough guy.
Yeah, I hear you. So now, what the interesting thing that I found is that I think there was a report just this week or so that the U.S. is actually going to overtake Russia in terms of oil production. And, you know, that kind of puts a different light on things, because one of the big issues with Russia was, obviously, for many years, I mean, they have just a crazy amount of natural resources.
Yeah.
And, you know, now, is that some of the reason, I was wondering, you know, hey, is Russia kind of getting a little bit cranky? Because all of a sudden, the oil production we have here and the various resources around the world that we're able to utilize are not going to be so reliant on not only them, but other places. And, you know, the whole idea of having you know, fuels that are going to be non-based on countries that we don't want to deal with, but we have to deal with. Mm. And now the electric cars, and then forget solar and all that. That's just not happening, it seems. But it's kind of an interesting turn of events these days. Now, is this kind of thing still going on? I mean, has China then taken over the lead in this whole idea of going around and maybe some of the small Asian countries going in there and doing the same kind of thing? I mean, we saw that they did a deal with Brazil back in 2008 or 9, where they bought oil at some ridiculously low level. I mean, in the 30s or 40s.
They being China.
Yeah, China. I mean, have they taken over this whole way of becoming an empire?
I think one thing we really need to understand is that the modern form of empire and the future form of empire is not nationalistic. It's really, when you come right down to it, it's really not about China or Russia or the United States, although at the moment it still seems that way. But the real driving power behind all of this are the big corporations, what I call the corporatocracy. China's economy would not be what it is today were it not for the multinational corporations, and mm-hmm. China knows this.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, anything China can do to bring down its price of oil will help in that regard, because it'll attract much more of the corporations coming into that country, cheap energy as well as cheap labor. But ultimately, what we're seeing here is that all of this is being driven by the big corporate powers. They're the ones that call the shots today. If you take just the United States, I think we could say during most of my lifetime, our elected officials wrote the laws. They don't anymore. Not the important laws. It's the big corporations that write them and run them through their. It's their lobbyists who write the laws, really, and run them through our elected officials whom they own. And, in this standoff we're seeing in Congress today, this quagmire that we're seeing, whatever you want to call it, I think a lot of that is corporate-driven. The corporations are very happy when Congress can't make any decisions, when it's hogtied, because that means that the laws don't change. And right now the laws favor big corporations extensively.
It is interesting how so much has been swept under the carpet over the last several years, where you see maybe a situation develop with a company. MF Global is an interesting one. MF Global comes up and, Corzine does all sorts of nasty things, so it seems, at least from what we read. And then what? It kind of like it's a big news item for a little while, and then it just disappears. Mm-hmm. And this happens over and over. And I think maybe also to what you're saying here, it has something a ringing of truth when we look at that nobody has been incarcerated from the entire debt debacle that we saw back in 2007 plus.
Right.
And long-term cap. I mean, really, have we ever seen, besides maybe Enron, which I think Skilling is getting got out or something, but was there any kind of criminal penalties put on anyone that you could recall, really?
No. Nobody big. If anybody gets taken down, it's underlings who are the fall people. And that tells you a hell of a lot, doesn't it? It tells you that these people are in the driver's seat.
Yeah,
we impeach presidents. We impeached Clinton. Of course, he wasn't found criminally guilty. He wasn't put in prison or anything, but he was impeached. But we don't do the same thing with the corporate executives. They're the really big ones, the ones that run Wall Street and our most important industries. The people, the members of what I call the corporatocracy, they are the emperors today. And
yeah.
They're beyond the law.
I mean, in a way, we've also seen the same thing with governments, whether the governments learn from them or whether they learn from the governments. I mean, how many things have we seen? Listen, the whole idea of the Fed putting in a practice of communications as a tool. Now, that's okay, we're using the communication tool. Well, what was that? Let's think about that, communication tool. It's basically rhetoric and manipulation of the markets by threat, as mm-hmm. I see it at least, by mm-hmm. saying that we're going to do this, we're going to do that, but not really utilizing anything more than a voice. The same thing happened in Japan, was what happened in Europe, where we saw that there was that Draghi speech a year and a half ago or so where he promised everything in the world, and then they didn't utilize anything because the markets believed it and the entire world believed it, so therefore it was true. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But, if a corporation did something like that, that wouldn't hold. Let's be honest. That would not hold. They couldn't get away with that. But anyway, let's kind of, I think from what I see the progressions of your books, you've become, maybe I'm wrong, but disenfranchised with the whole Western culture. Is that true? Would you say that would be true?
No.
Okay.
I have tremendous hope that we're going to change things, that we are going to turn things around, because I do see people raising consciousness. But I think what this is going to take is a new consciousness, a new level of consciousness, something that indigenous cultures that I also do a lot of work with have prophesied for thousands of years that we're entering a time right now with rising consciousness. And I think it is rising. The fact we're having this discussion on the show, and I have discussions like this frequently across the world. You know, in the last months, I had three major Russian TV crews in my house on an island off the coast of the state of Washington. I traveled to around Southeast Asia, Europe, the Middle East, South America, around the United States, all within this year. And everywhere I go, I really feel that people are beginning to wake up. They're getting it. The 1% is screwing the 99%, and people around the world are getting that. So I have great hope in that. And I don't know whether that's faith in Western culture so much as it's faith in human beings. I think we're getting it. And whether we're in the Western cultures or whether we're talking about China, I was in China recently, hearing young people there waking up, saying we've got to create a better world. We've got to pay attention to the environment and social issues. So I have great hope that we are waking up, and as we wake up, we will force things to change. At the same time, the corporatocracy, the status quo, is stepping in firmly, because it's realizing that this is happening on some level. And in fact, that should give the rest of us more strength. It's like martial arts. It's like Aikido. So, you know, the fact that they're resisting so strongly is an indication that they're feeling threatened.
But the power that they have to change minds with the money, simply from commercials. I mean, a lot of times you see, for example, clothing. And clothing, how do people then become, oh, look at the new style. Where does that come from? Well, it comes from primarily seeing others. And where do they get that from? Well, possibly TV, movies, commercials. The ability for companies to change or to shift their ability to shift the person's interests or direction. And I find that pretty amazing. And one of the things you do see is that I found that westernization of cultures, particularly from diet, just because you could see the real results of that, in India and in China, having the highest level of diabetes per capita around the world is really, I think it's directly blamed on the westernization of their diet. So, you know, some of the things, there's a, you know, a grassroots level of ability to change minds, which is great. You know, I'm not knocking, obviously. I'm just saying that it seems like they have a lot more ability to do so when they're blasting it on TVs, putting it on the side of walls and buses. How do you conquer something like that?
Well, there's no question that is the powerful, the use of the media. But there's also no question that we've changed that many times. I mean, they fought like hell to convince us that there was no global warming, and that if there was global warming, it wasn't caused by human or economic activities. I think now, you know, most everybody in the world has bought into the fact that that's untrue. And the scientific community has come out very strongly, finally. But for a long time, the big corporations seemed to own the scientific community. But that's changed. You know, when I was growing up, there was tremendous racial discrimination in the United States, and that's changed. We still got some work to do on it. There's no question.
Yeah.
Women. When I went to business school, I think there were 250 students in my class, and three of them were women. Now there's more women than men. We were told that women couldn't be good businessmen. That's, you know, of good business executives.
Right.
That's changed. I mean, concepts do change. You know, look at religion. How that's changed over the years. Our attitudes do change, despite the fact that the status quo desperately tries to keep us in the status quo, to not let us change. But we do change. And I see that happening big time now, perhaps like never before, actually. And it's global, because I think for the first time in history, we're understanding that every sentient being on this planet is facing the same crises. We never felt that way before. Florida had hurricanes and Asia had tsunamis. But today we're all faced with climate change. We know the glaciers are melting everywhere. We know the oceans are rising. We know species are going extinct at a horrible rate, while human populations are growing a bit too fast.
Right.
We know that resources are declining at an accelerating rate. We're getting it. And we can't discard the fact that for the first time we're all communicating with each other or have that ability. To the most remote corners of the planet now, we can talk through Skype and streaming and so on. So all the modern technology, social networking, is having a huge, huge impact. It's the equivalent of the Gutenberg press. Where before the Gutenberg press, basically in the Western world, every bit of written material was described by the Catholic Church. And when the press came along, that all changed. So we're at a time in history like that now, and we're really, I think, understanding in en masse that we live on a very fragile space station, but this one doesn't have any shuttles.
Yeah. And no eject.
Yeah, we can't get off. We got to take care of it. I really think we're getting it. I think this is a watershed moment. And despite the power of the dollar at owning the media, we can get beyond that. And we've done it in the past, and we can continue to do it. I think we're doing it.
Now, one of the things I've had personal self debate about is the benefit or the detriment of social media in places. For example, there's something to be said about how there is awareness created because of the ability for people, like you said, in remote parts of the world to now have access to the outside world so they can see what's going on and find out what's happening and be much more aware of what the potential is or, what they can do and go and all. Now, on the other hand, I say, well, things may have been, they may be people, what you don't know, you don't know. And what people didn't know, they weren't upset about not having. Now, I'm not suggesting that anybody shouldn't have, house and air conditioning and food and all, whatever it is that they need or the necessities. But some of the recent uprisings in the Middle East, I think we could put on the fact that there's a much greater amount of visibility to the outside world. And you want to call it jealousy, you want to call it, a desire to have it. I mean, some of it's good, but some of it's a little bit disruptive, isn't it?
I don't know. I mean, disruptive, but it's inevitable. I mean, it's kind of a moot point, isn't it, really? It's happening.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like saying, I spend a lot of time with indigenous cultures in the Amazon. I have since 1968 when I was a Peace Corps volunteer living with hunters and gatherers. I can say that I think their life was great back when they were hunters and gatherers, and it's too bad they couldn't stay that way, that modern technology is coming in there. But most of them wouldn't agree with that. They like the fact that they can now communicate with the outside world, that they can have satellite cell phones, before that, two-way radios. Who am I to say, what's right or what's wrong? I remember my grandmother, lamenting the fact that cars went so fast that it's so easy to get to get to New York. It used to be a big deal to go from New Hampshire to Boston or New York, and suddenly it became something you could do in a matter of hours. Lamenting the fact that everybody was talking to everybody else on the telephone, everybody was sitting around watching television at night. But the fact of the matter is these things are happening, and we can't keep anybody under glass. I think the real challenge here is how do we continue with a value system that honors the Earth, that honors our connection to the Earth, to other people, to other cultures, to other life forms on this planet. How do we raise our consciousness? And I think that's much more important than any discussion we can have about whether we should have cell phones or not, because they're here, or whether the Achuar in the middle of the Amazon should have cell phones or not, because they're going to have them regardless of what we want.
Right.
And so, but what we can look at is what do they have in their value system that allows them to understand what it is to be a tree and how important a tree is to our lives. How do we bring that in? And I think that's the challenge of the modern time. How do we raise our consciousness?
Consciousness? I totally agree, but at the same time, and I agree it's all happening, and so it is kind of a moot point, but it's just a discussion that if, and this is, again, this is not per se something I believe in. I'm just trying to run through this. But right. If we give, or if they take, or if they have the ability to go forward in terms of technology and industrialization and modernization, then you kind of say, wait a minute, though, by doing that, it adds to the problem that we already have if we believe that there is the climate change going on, because that's just going to add more people and more more problems to the whole climate. You know, now, I'm not suggesting that some should have, so some shouldn't. I'm not saying that. But if we think that it is a human-based issue that, hey, you know what, we're consuming this and we're maybe doing it ineffectively and we're causing problems to the climate and the environment, you know, as you start modernizing and you start, quote-unquote, westernizing, doesn't that collide with the whole idea of trying to make the world a place that has less impact on the environment?
Well, if we consider that less than 5% of the world's population lives in the United States, and we consume almost 30% of the world's resources and create probably a little more than 30% of the world's pollution, I think the answer becomes quite simple. We've got to change our way. We shouldn't be worried about the Chinese or the Africans or the Latin Americans. Let us, if the world looks to us for an example, they're all trying to emulate us, and they can't. 5% of us consuming 30% of the world's resources, China cannot do that. They may be trying to. India right. can't do it. So what we need to do is set a new example here at home. And I think we shouldn't be worrying about what the rest of the world is going to do. The rest of the world is following us.
Yeah.
And they can't do it. It's impossible. Right. It's statistically impossible. So what we need to do is really look to ourselves and see what can we do? How can we create a new model that's viable? Because the model we've created is not viable. It's an abject failure.
Yeah. I'm just throwing this out for discussion points because I find the whole thing a little bit of a circular. And I agree with you, by the way, that, you know, we have to change. And one of the things that I was hopeful for was that in 2000 and we'll call it 6, 7, 8, around there, that there was going to be a reset, somewhat of a realization of what was going on, and that there would be a humbling of all of us, including myself. I mean, everybody, I'm not excluding myself, that there would be a humbling. And, you know, you snap back, and it did happen for maybe 2 or 3 weeks, but it seems that we went right back to the old ways again in terms of the economics, in terms of the corporations, in terms of the, not everything, but a lot of the things that went on. You know, it just seemed to, we forget about it very quickly, don't we?
I think that there's been a tremendous change in consciousness. And as I said before, the status quo is digging in. But things have changed. I mean, the fact that the President of the United States decided that he had to go to Congress before declaring war or taking any aggressive action against Syria has defied almost 60 years of presidential history. Before Obama, every president, going back to Johnson and even Eisenhower and Kennedy to a certain degree, said, I have the right to go to attack another country without approval from Congress. Obama said, I have the right, but I'm not going to do it. He's the first one. I think that reflects a change of consciousness. It may also just be good politics, but I do think it reflects a change of consciousness. That's one simple thing. The fact that we are admitting that there's climate change and human beings are causing it, that just about everybody has, the scientific community has unanimously come out to say that, that's a huge change. And, you know, 5, 6 years is a blink in history. But I'm finding as I go around, when I speak at universities, I ask to have dinner with a dozen or two or three dozen students beforehand, and I always ask them, so let's go around the table. I want to hear from each one of you. What's your goal? Back in 2005, 2006, the goal, they're all stating in business schools and law schools at least, was to make a lot of money and have a lot of power. Mm-hmm. I don't hear that anymore. I don't hear it in this country. I don't hear it in China. I don't hear it in Asia or Middle East. What I hear is, we want to have kids, and we realize that this world that we've been creating is not a good world for kids, so we need to change that.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, I have three of my own, and it's you have to wonder what's going to be next for them, you know, and how are they going to have, although I understand my parents said the same thing, you know, how are they going to have what we have, but we managed to. But I hear you, and I, by the way, I do a lot of traveling as well, and I see how others live. And one of the things, by the way, that I do recommend highly is that people go to other places. I'm not talking about France and Paris. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about go to other places around the world that maybe aren't so shishi, that aren't so, upscale. and spend a little time there and see how they operate. I mean, when I'm in Bali and I walk into a person's quote-unquote house and I see their kitchen, which is pretty much just a mud hut that has a wood-burning area that they use a bamboo stick to blow on to keep the fire hot, and $20 essentially buys their family a month worth of rice that they'll eat. And that's a bit of an awakening experience.
Yeah.
You know, there's not like they can go to McDonald's and just, you know, order what they want if they want fast food, you know, or if you go to just outside of Myanmar and into in areas of I believe it was Thailand. And you know, you're sitting with someone that all they do all day is strip bamboo, little slivers, long slivers of bamboo. They're stripping all day for like a dollar, a gigantic bundle. To right. So people can use for roofs and homes and all that. It's quite an amazing experience. Or even, by the way, many other countries where you go into a cab and they drop you off and you don't tip because it's just not what it is. They don't expect something from you. It's their job to do what they're doing.
Right.
And they get paid for it. It's a whole different way of thinking.
But I would like to say, you know, I would just like to invite your listeners to sign up for my newsletter at my website, johnperkins.org, or go to dreamchange.org and stay in touch. And I'm speaking around the country, and people can find out on johnperkins.org where I'll be speaking. I'd love to meet some of your listeners face-to-face.
And we'll make sure to have all that information on the notes of this episode. John Perkins, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Keep up your great work.
Thanks. Bye-bye. It's interesting how far he's come from his original books, from a hardcore discussion of the early goings-on of some of the secret societies in government and how we took over the world, to now full circle to trying to repair the world. You know, in Hebrew they have a saying, it's tikkun olam, which is to repair the world, and each and every person is responsible for their own level of repairing and making sure the world is a better place for the long term and for the next generations to come. I don't know. It's we kind of got a little bit off topic there into some of this, because I did want to bring him in to talk about some of the things that he has done in the past. And I thought it was very interesting, especially in a time when we're seeing that, you know, with the IRS scandals and, you know, government with the NSA and the Snowden situation, what's going on. You know, the secrecy veil has seemingly been a little bit lifted, but you know, some of it, I guess, in the spirit and in the name of government security and the security of you and me, has to be, you know, kept that way. Let's talk about some earnings. I have a list of about 77 companies that are earning, putting out their earnings numbers this week, and there are probably about 10 or so on there that I think are very interesting. Now, I'm going to pass up like the Goldmans, because we saw last week that we had, Wells Fargo, and we had also JP Morgan, which who knows what to make out of those numbers, because there are so many differentials and footnotes and really odd transactions that are passed through their earnings on a quarterly basis that I don't even think that the analysts have all the spreadsheets that can actually try their best. Well, let me go one step further. I don't think even the companies have an idea of what they're putting out. It's very difficult. Companies that large with that many moving parts, not only with all sorts of different accounting methodologies that can be used, how do you know? It's almost impossible. Let's talk about those, some of the things that we do know. J.B. Hunt. Now, J.B. Hunt is a transportation company and trucking, and this is a good metric to see what kind of movement is going on from manufacturers to the retailers, etc. Now, when you see a lot more miles driven, not only the net revenue, but miles driven, if you can see that in any of the numbers that we're seeing in, whether it's trucking or maybe even in the transportation for railroads, that's an important thing to look at, because it will bring you the culmination of all the amount of shipments that are going. It's not just the distance, of course. You can count containers also when it comes to shipping. But we'll look at them. We're going to see them before the market on the 15th, looking for 78 cents on a billion four. Then we have CSX also, which is a transportation, but we have Intel coming out. Intel has been struggling. It's done a lot better recently, of course. They're looking for about 54 cents on $13 billion. Estimates have been reduced down about 2% over the last 4 weeks on both revenue and sales as well. I'm going to pass over a few of these names like Yahoo, Johnson & Johnson, Schwab. Let's get to Stanley Black & Decker. Now, this is a good one to look at when we're looking at the construction industry because, obviously, they have a lot of tools, obviously. And when we look at some of the components of the construction industry, you can look at lumber. You can look at, obviously, new homes sold. You can look at land prices and land being sold. But you also want to look at some of the underlying to see how much is being bought in new construction equipment, which is also small items like Stanley Black & Decker has. And you can see what it's looking like from a position of individuals for an employment standpoint. So we're looking at about $1.38 of profit on the EPS and about $2.8 billion. Now, we're also going to see eBay. eBay, I think, has an interesting thought about it here. eBay could do really well in almost any situation, right? So if the economy is good and people are doing well, there's more things being bought, more things being sold. Very interesting. Now, when the economy slows down, well, eBay could do really well because a lot of people are trying to sell things, and they're going to probably sell things from their surplus, if you will, that they have, individuals, and they're going to do virtual garage sales. And that being the case, maybe they're going to be getting rid of some things, and that does benefit eBay as well. Of course, eBay also has that PayPal component, which is directly relates to the amount of transactions that are done because people pay with credit cards or with online finance of some sort, online credit. And PayPal is a monster, just an absolute monster in that. There's some competition these days that is coming out there, people realizing, hey, you know what? Wow, that PayPal really did well. Why don't we get in that market? And that's very viable. Not just the Visas and the MasterCards or the names that do the payment processing, but a lot of companies are really pushing hard for this. And there's some new versions of all this would come to mobile payments, like Square as a good example. We also have American Express. That's going to back up the discussion about the amount of spending that's going on or if it's slowing down. So we're going to see those two on the 16th. On eBay, they're looking for about 63 cents. This is after the market on the 16th. And about $8 billion, $3.9 billion on eBay, $8.2 on American Express. Now we go down the list. There's some other technology. We have IBM. Now IBM, I got to tell you something. IBM, I think the number is something like 17% of their employees reside in the U.S. and the rest outside the U.S. Now you say, well, that's okay. IBM is a global presence, but I think the representation of their employees is disproportionate when it comes to how much business they're doing. Now, IBM over the years has been buying back their shares at a regular basis, therefore increasing their EPS by taking shares and retiring them. And this is something that I've always said, hey, it's really good to do share buybacks from the perspective that you believe that your company is going to be doing much better, retiring some shares, maybe even then looking to possibly issue some debt at these low rates. Oh, those are all really good because if you have a dividend, It's really beneficial. You don't have to pay the extra dividend out. It comes back in. You have less cost. And you reduce your debt down or debt service. That's also good. Well, we may have run that course a little bit and run to the end of the rope on this because interest rates are pretty much the low they're ever going to be or close to it. And on top of that, I think there's a question about IBM's overall revenue. And the problem is we're talking about this on a gross basis. Now, when you look at it on a share level basis, obviously with less shares outstanding, the earnings and the potential revenue will look better if they keep on retiring their shares. And that's the game they played with absolute masterfully over the last, I don't know, decade plus. It keeps on retiring shares. I'm going to be very curious to watch what's going on with that. Then we have also UnitedHealthcare. And let me just give you the number on IBM. Let's see. IBM is looking for about $3.96 on $24 billion of revenue. Now, UnitedHealthcare, here's the thing about UnitedHealthcare. The question is going to be, we're still not in the whole Affordable Care Act. It just started up, and there's a lot of problems, of course, and we know about that. The question is going to be, how does this affect the HMOs, the hospitals, the doctors, maybe some of the prescription medicine, you know, the companies that are in the pharmaceutical area. Also, for example, the companies that are in the medical supply business. This is going to be very interesting to watch, and they're the first one of a major kind that's going to be reporting. There's a few others. You got St. Jude this week. You have Abbott this week. But this is going to be, I think, an important one to look at. So we're looking at $1.53 on about $31 billion of revenue. Now, Philip Morris will be coming up. Now, this is a little bit different. We have Philip Morris is going to be on the 17th. They're coming out pre-market at about 7 a.m. looking for about $1.43 on about $7.9 billion of revenue. Now, what's going to be interesting about Philip Morris is how much, if any, the smokeless tobacco, and I'm talking about the vapors, not the other kinds of like pipes and chewing tobacco and things like that. I'm talking about the vapor, the smokeless tobacco. That's probably a better way to look at it. The smokeless tobacco that is having an impact on them. We've already seen that there's a couple of Japanese companies in the tobacco area. You know, they're big on tobacco over there that are looking to actually buy up some of these companies. Now, whether they're going to just shut them down so they're not competitors anymore, or whether they're going to try to do what they can to go next generation. It reminds me of the bricks and mortar to the online space controversy that we had, or maybe even the VHS and Beta, but in a smaller manner, where there was this endless discussion of which would be better and which would work. And the companies that eventually came out of all that, you know, Blockbuster is no longer, but Netflix is. We have Hulu that came out of this. Whether or not they're going to embrace this and be smart about it, or be dumb about it like the car manufacturers were back in the 2000s, not coming up to the newest level of customer requirement and just sticking to their own old line of thought that just if it's working, okay, just leave it alone. We don't need to do anything different. That's going to be a big issue. So they're going to be coming out with that. Then we have, again, Verizon, and we have Goldman coming out that day. We also have Align Technology. They make the Invisalign for the braces. And this has been a company that's been very choppy. They've had some good quarters. They've had some bad quarters, but they seem to be pretty well set in terms of where they were and the outlook from last time. We'll see how that plays this time. Looking for 30 cents on about $158 million of revenue. Chipotle is coming out on the 17th. Now, one of the things that really benefits Chipotle is not only diners, but the lower cost of foods that we've seen. The corn prices, chicken prices, that's been very good for them. As a matter of fact, the opposite was seen when they were moving, when those prices were moving up. It was horrible. Looking for about $1.78 on $5.6 billion of revenue. We have Google, Las Vegas Sands. Now, with the slowing of China, this will be a real interesting thing to look at when we look inside of Las Vegas Sands and to see how their China properties are doing. When we look how the strength or weakness comparatively of Macau is doing, you know, that's going to be a big issue. Everybody thinks that these companies have been just not only on fire, but are going to continue to do so for some time. And we'll see. I've had my doubts about Las Vegas Sands for a while. They've come a long way from the depths of where they were. Wynn also is doing very well. But if China is slowing down, that could be a very big impact for them. And just think about Yum Brands, what we saw there. So they're going to be aftermarket on the 17th also, 75 cents on $3.4 billion. Nucor, steel company, a serial disappointer when it comes to the last several years. We're going to be looking at them on the 17th also, looking for about 39 cents on $4.7 billion. And then more transportation with Kansas City Southern on the 18th. General Electric, of course, is important on the 18th as well, and Morgan Stanley. Now, General Electric is going to be coming out before the market, and they're a conglomerate, so it's tough to really see anything in particular with them, but they are a good read for the global economy because they basically service the global economy with just all sorts of things. And they're looking for 35 cents on $36 billion. And then finally, let me just wrap it up with Morgan Stanley. Morgan Stanley is really going to talk about the health of the European markets and the European banks. They probably have the biggest exposure to that area. So when you see that the numbers from Morgan Stanley are getting better, and that correlates well with the fact that you're seeing, okay, there's some stabilization in Europe, hey, that's a good thing to look at. Now, the opposite true is also true. If you have the Morgan Stanley starting to slow down, whether it's in trading or in maybe in brokerage revenue, or you're seeing that there is a bit of a hole in the European components, now you got to pick up and think about that and see what's going on in Europe as well. Because we know that Europe really still has a lot of problems that are just not solved and not going to be solved for a long time. And I don't care what Draghi says and what kind of butterflies he floats out there. You're not going to be able to just do it on hope alone. That will help, but you need some backing of that too. We're going to end it right there. I want to thank you for joining me. And of course, you got to check out DH Unplugged this week, where we have our Closest to the Pin contest and trigger charts, where we have all those wonderful and very interesting algorithmically designed charting features for TradeStation. Just go to triggercharts.com. You find out when we have all the webinars coming up and all that. And of course, the Trigger Point Research, where you have it breaking up, breaking down, and you get it by text message or your email, and you know exactly what to do, when to do it. And you know what? It's been working out very well. So I think that you owe yourself an opportunity to do it. It's a 14-day free trial, but it's also pretty cheap if you think about it. And we're giving you all the heads up ahead of time of what to be looking for. So that's over at triggerpointresearch.com. Thanks for joining me. I'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.